Can the whole universe be a giant organic organism? How to fight back against conspiracy theories? Which astronomical events do I anticipate the most? And Q&A plus, who would I interview from entire history given such a chance? All this and more in this question show. It's time for the question show. Your questions, my answers, as always, wherever you are across my channel. If a question pops in your brain, just write it down. I'll gather them up and I will answer them here. All right, let's get into the questions.
Trance Milkman, what astronomical event do you want to see the most? I want to see a bright comet. I rail about this all the time, but I really do. Actually, that's not the thing I would like to see the most. Like, I would like to see a bright comet. I've seen Hale-Bopp, Hakodake back in the late 90s. They were amazing. I would like to see a meteor storm. Like, we've seen meteor showers, and I've seen strong meteor showers where you had maybe a couple of hundred meteors an hour during the Leonids 1 year. But in meteor storms, you're seeing sometimes tens of thousands of meteors an hour. It really looks like the sky is falling. Wouldn't that be amazing? I think the last time one happened was in the 60s. So they happen about once a century. And that's a thing I want to see, is a meteor storm. Tom Colby, I think the universe is organic and we are just a speck inside a larger organism. So one of the things that science does really well is helps us distinguish between vibes and what appears to be evidence that matches our observations. And for the longest time, really for most of human history, we've relied on vibes, right? Why is there lightning? Because the gods are angry. Why do we have good weather versus bad weather? Where do people go when they die? Well, you know, all this kind of stuff. We have all these just sort of vibes, and different cultures come up with their explanations. And these turn into pantheons of their gods. These turn into various myths and sort of cultural things. And it really wasn't until the scientific revolution, like 500 years ago, where we got to this place where we had to come up with a more rigorous way of being able to sort of analyze the natural world around us and come up with methodologies where you sort of go into it without any expectations, you try to understand nature as it is. And that through that process, you can sort of come up with things that are repeatable, that anybody can perform the same experiment and get the same outcome. And then that gives you progress. And that's when our human society moved into this sort of modern place that we are today with all of our technology and all of our scientific understanding of everything around us. And yet it all often comes back to those sorts of hunches, right? You know, the feeling that you're having, where you're like, okay, like I think the universe seems organic. When I look out at the universe, the way things are balanced, when you look at the shape of the large scale structure of the universe, it looks very similar to neurons in the brain. It looks very similar to the kinds of shapes that algae colonies will grow. Like, there's something very organic to that. And so that's the hunch. That's the sort of the eureka moment, right? Where you're going like, huh, maybe this is like the nature of the universe. This is some aspect to the way things work. And up until 500 years ago, that's where people stopped. You know, someone go like, I think the universe is kind of organic, right? And someone go like, yeah, you're right. And then 100 years later, there's like some kind of sort of cultural awareness that's just been locked in. And what science does is says, okay, great. But now you have to prove it. Now you have to find evidence that matches what you're saying. If the universe is organic, what does that mean? What things can you observe that would tell you that it is organic versus the things that would tell you that it's not organic? And then if you find those things, can you use it? Does it have any explanatory power? Can you explain some of the aspects of the universe, some of the mysteries of the universe using this theory in a cohesive way? Can you make new predictions about the universe? Can you explain it in math? So that people can actually sort of make these predictions very rigorous. And so I think whenever you have these sorts of thoughts, you want to try to approach it in a scientific way to say, okay, how does this explain the universe? What would I see if this was true? What would I see if this was not true? How would I disprove my theory and keep going with it? And this is what leads to a fascination with science. And this can lead to a whole career for you. So, you know, go with it, man. But do it right. Richard Louis Pierre. Since looking out means looking back in time, isn't it possible that light from sentient worlds just hasn't reached us yet? Yeah, of course. But that just means that the universe is more sparsely populated than people had originally expected. And so if the nearest civilization from us, you know, when you think about the kinds of impact that a really advanced civilization could have, like if they've had billions of years of technological advancement before we came along, they could have a very large impact on their galaxy. That's why people are always talking about looking for, say, type 3 civilizations, where they're rearranging the stars in their galaxy, like the kinds of things that would seem very obvious. We would see stars covered in Dyson spheres, and then we would see an expanding group of Dyson spheres. That's the kind of stuff that you would expect to see really far away. We don't see any of that. We just see what looks like wilderness in all directions. So that would mean that if they're out there, then they're very far away. Robin Hanson, you know, we talked about the Great Filter. He has also proposed the grabby aliens hypothesis. He assumes that some technological civilization is going to try to gather up as much space as it can. It's going to send its probes out at close to the speed of light and colonize star system after star system and make physical changes to the star systems in a way that is obvious to us as an observer. And so we would look out into the universe and we'd see, you know, the way you would look across the landscape and see there's the place where the city is and there's the place where the forest is. The forest and the mountains, that's the nature. And then there's the city, which is the evidence of an advanced civilization. We look out in the universe and we see the space equivalent of the forest versus the cities. And the fact is that we don't. We just see forest when we look out. Dark forest. So we just see forests and mountains out of the universe, metaphorically speaking. And so then the question is, Hanson says that because these civilizations are going to be expanding at roughly the speed of light, like just shy of the speed of light, we won't see those civilizations until they sweep past us. Suddenly, you know, before we saw wilderness, then boom, civilization. We're now in a city. In a space city. And that because we don't see them, you can use that to calculate how far away those civilizations are. And his point is that those civilizations are most likely tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of light years away from us. So we're not going to see them for tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of years before their civilizations sweep past us and start to fill up the universe. There's a great video on YouTube by Rational Animations talking about grabby aliens, and they just do a terrific job of explaining the process and sort of the thinking process. I have, you know, issues with the grabby aliens hypothesis, but in general, I really sort of enjoy that as an explanation. I've also interviewed Robin Hanson, so if you want to sort of hear his take on it directly, if you just do a search on my channel, you'll find it's like an hour and a half long conversation with him, and he's great. Like he's a very funny guy, very quick, lots of ideas. Many I disagree with. People think I was a little hard on him. But anyway, yeah, check that out here on the channel.
It's time to shout out our new patrons at the $5 level and above. Mark Olivier Rochon, Richard Lyons, The Interplanetary Podcast, Thomas Vergace, Gregory Eaton, Don Wheeler, Frederick Simon, Moth from Roseg, Lorenz, and Finsky777. Join our club at patreon.com/universe today.
Sean 12, do you get frustrated with the growing popularity of the wacky conspiracy contrails, controlling weather, flat earth, the jab, etc.? Yeah, I mean, like this tends to trigger a rant in me. And so I just get sad. I just get sad that science is a methodology that works really well, that has given us a ton of benefits in our society. And there's this kind of war on expertise right now. And it's not just science, it's just kind of everything. It's policy, all kinds of things. People are railing against expertise. And, you know, at the heart of it, I think there's some legitimate concerns. There's an accumulation of power. There's an accumulation of wealth. People are feeling marginalized by society and they're looking for a cause, they're looking for a reason why. And people are able to redirect, people are able to prop up the causes. And science happens to be one of the things that has been propped up as one of the causes for the problems that people are experiencing. And so it's caused a real sort of aggression towards science. It's something that's very unique, I think, to Western culture, very different in Eastern culture, where it's sort of being a scientist, being an engineer is sort of seen as the ticket out of poverty is seen as the ticket of becoming a very advanced society. And, you know, maybe that's just the thing, you just don't realize how good you've got it until it's gone. And that's, you know, I think we're in the, unfortunately, the find out stage. When you have measles cases rising, you have coastal erosion, like you have all these problems that have been predicted by science. And not only are people not taking the prediction seriously, they're hostile to the scientists and railing on them as attention starved, money grubbing, whatever, right? Like, it's ridiculous. Like, when you look at all of the possible players, all the people who have all the stakeholders in climate change, right? Scientists don't make very much money. Who does make a lot of money? And, you know, if there was serious action on climate change, would hurt their bottom line? I wonder. But they've been, you know, they have money to redirect people's attention to distract them. And so it's just causing a real sort of takedown on science. And it just makes me sad. Now, for a lot of the specific stuff, I just don't deal with it. I cognitively disconnect from it. It's just that I don't think it's interesting to entertain clearly non-scientific theories. And I've sort of, you know, I've kind of gone overboard in dealing with the 3i Atlas stuff just because it's so outrageous. But I find just like in general, it's like you're rewarding the wrong audience, right? My audience, the people who I want to interact with, are the people who love science, who are fascinated by space and astronomy, who watched space shuttle launches, who were there for the moon landings, who are excited to see new pictures coming from the Vera Rubin telescope, who can't wait to hear more about what's happening in space exploration and astronomy. And they're my favorite, right? Those are the people who I want to lavish my attention on, is the people who want this stuff, who are interested, who have a genuine appreciation for science. I don't have time for the people who, to whatever degree, are railing against science or are making stuff up wholesale, right? We can choose the conversations that we have in this world. We don't have to spend time talking to the people who are spouting nonsense. That's a them problem, not a you problem. And by you engaging with them and talking with them and chatting with them about it and trying to convince them, and that then becomes your problem and you don't need to. So, you know, in general, when I'm strong, I tend to just focus on talking about the science, talking about the interesting stuff that's actually happening to an audience who understands and believes in it. And that's enough. You know, I think there are a lot of channels that do well by directly confronting the nonsense. And, you know, I think about, like, say, Professor Dave Explains or Simon Dan. And that's just on me. Like, it's just on me. Like, I just don't feel like putting on my armor and wading into combat with people who are spouting nonsense. And I think it's important work because someone needs to push back against it. But it's not me. It's not for me. So I just, you know, I'm definitely frustrated. But I don't really find it's very useful for my time to try and push back against it just directly. I just would rather spend my time entertaining you. Ian, if you could interview any astronaut or astronomer from history, who would it be and what would you ask? I would love to talk to Galileo. Like, I think that's the person, I don't know like what I would ask him. He was like the first person to take a telescope and really look to the sky and study all of the things that human beings had been examining with their eyeballs for thousands of years. I mean, you look back to the Persian astronomers, the ancient Chinese astronomers, the various astronomers in Mesoamerican stuff, right? Like, they really understood the movements of the sky. When you think about Hipparchus, who was this ancient Greek astronomer, he used a sighting tube, like just a tube of metal that he looked through to be able to mark the positions of the stars. And he mapped like 700 stars in the sky and had positions and had even tried to verify that the Earth went around the sun, but they couldn't measure the stellar parallax from the Earth well enough with his sighting tube. With better instruments, maybe would have figured it out. And then in the 1600s, 1610, Galileo turns a telescope on the sky for the first time. Like, these rudimentary lenses had been used a little bit for battlefield. He's like, what if we point these things up and look at Jupiter or, you know, the moon or things like that? And when he did, everything changed, right? That it was just like suddenly he was seeing all these things in a way that nobody had ever seen them. And he saw them all. Like, he didn't just see a new aspect of the moon that nobody had seen. He saw the new aspect of the moon, the rings of Saturn, Jupiter, the moons of Jupiter, how Venus goes through phases. He saw that the Milky Way was composed into stars and a lot of other stuff. And clearly just had this dramatic effect on his perspective of the universe. And he wouldn't shut up about it after that. So I would love to just have that conversation with what it was like to point that telescope in the sky for the first time and what happened. That's the, by far, like this, you know, people always ask me this question, and that's the one that pops in my mind every time, because so many of our modern advances, he was the line in between the before times and the after times.
All right, those are all the questions that we had this episode. Thank you, everyone who put your questions into the YouTube comments, everybody who joined me for the live show. This is the last episode that I will be recording from the road. Of course, by the time you watch it, I will be back home and ready to get back to work in my normal environment. All right, I'm going to give you some sort of final thoughts about this sort of trip and travel in general. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Barely Griffin, Brian Bodie, Caribbean, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bielak, Sign Elson, Dark Fanger, Dave Verbaugh, David Gilton, David Mass, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Switz, Michael Purcell, Nordspace, OneStepForAnimals.org, Porobuck, Rank Haidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Feller Menley, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So this is it. This is the final episode that I am recording while we're on the road. I'm in a Airbnb in a place called Pak Chong, which is just outside of the Khao Yai National Park in Thailand. And this is one of the few places in Thailand where you can see wild elephants. So not one that's in a reserve or not ones that's on a farm or a zoo. You can just go into the wild and try to see elephants. And it's harder, but this is the way the elephants like to be. And unfortunately, I failed to see elephants. I went on a bunch of trips into the forest and saw lots of other amazing animals, porcupines and monkeys, but I didn't see elephants, which was too bad. But they're out there somewhere. It's been a great time. And I just want to give a huge thank you to really the people of Thailand for being such a wonderful and inviting country. Like, there's just a friendliness and a welcoming to foreigners and tourists that you just kind of don't experience in many other nations. And the food is amazing. And a lot of the sort of just the way life goes here is quite fun. And a lot of stuff I'll sort of take back and think about for years to come. But I am also looking forward to getting back and sleeping in my regular bed and having access to my internet and all of my gear and Douglas fir trees around everywhere to cut down. Anyway, all right. I will see you next time, and I will be back in my normal environment with a haircut. All right, we'll see you next time.